Welcome. Hi. Good Sunday evening. Welcome to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. I have some news for you. The show will be moving next Sunday to the much more, I think, civilized hours of 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. So you will not have to stay up really late drinking. You can hear the show at 7 to 9. I'll let you know. I'll send out a Twitter thing and a Facebook thing. And I will continue to have the same kind of lively guests. My first guest is one of the liveliest people I've ever known. She cut a huge, huge swath here many years ago as a dynamic public relations woman working for Margie Korshak and handling such places as Arnie's. And then she went away. She got married. She had four kids. She started teaching. She's written some best-selling books. And now she returns in a book called Camp Girls, Fireside Lessons on Friendship, Courage, and Loyalty. Good evening, Iris Krasno.
Hello, Rick Kogan.
What are you giggling? Were you giggling?
Yeah, well, I'm giggling because, you know, it's 10 o'clock where I am. Like, I could have been on the 8 o'clock show.
Well, no, we'll do it again because we'll do it again because you're bound to write another book within a year. This book, not being a camp kid, this book wound up, I went into it with a bit of trepidation. But I wound up being really charmed and delighted, and I learned something. You paint, and I think a lot of people do this, and I think a lot of people at this time, though you're not returning to camp this June, are you?
No.
It's closed, right?
This is the Camp Agawock for Girls, mm-hmm. which draws its major population from the Chicago area. And was started by a Chicagoan about 100 years ago. And I went there from age 8 to 18. And I started in 1963.
But then as you write in the book, the first sentence in the book is, I still go to the summer camp I loved as a child, having returned after a 40-year hiatus to resurrect the camp magazine where I got my literary start at the age of 8. There is something, and you paint a portrait of this place, and believe me, Iris Krasno, I've heard from a number of women who went to that camp with you saying, oh, I can't wait to hear Iris, I can't wait to hear Iris. It's a bond. You call it here a something of a sisterhood, right?
We're sisters bound not of blood, but of history, love, and loyalty. Although my sister Fran did go to camp with me. I mean, if you can. So 40 years later, I was 59 years old. I am not still 59. I do feel, nor are you. But, you know, I returned 40 years later. I was at our camp reunion. I think it was our 85th reunion. And the new owner of the camp, who's much younger than me, mm-hmm. she was reading one of my books, and I was very excited. I said, oh, my God, Mary, you know, I got my literary start at Camp Agawock, you know, 100 years ago.
Sure.
She said, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, we had this camp magazine called Agawock, and she looked at me really puzzled, and I said, you know, it was the best. And she said, would you ever? And I said, oh, my God, what if I? And so at 59, I went back to camp. This would have been my seventh summer back, but we did close, as many camps closed, because of the pandemic.
Yeah, of course, of course. One of the interesting things here, Iris, in chapter one is actually titled Independence, and you make a really good case for how a summer at camp will foster independence. What I'm curious about later on, you seem really hooked on camp in general. Later on, you married a nice guy, an architect. You had four handsome sons. When those sons went to camp, you volunteered at their camp to work, yes?
Yes, I worked. So I think I've gone to camp since I was four. And I'm 65. So I went to day camp from 4 to 8. And then I went to Agawock from 8 to 18. And then I skipped 40 years at that camp. But when the boys, we live on the East Coast, so the boys went to Camp Brackett Lake in the Adirondacks, and they went for about 8 years, and I went with them. I'm sure that
didn't you feel? Wait a minute. I know. But when you make a case throughout the book about what a refreshing, wonderful thing it is to be away from your parents for a while, and how empowering that is.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, here you are shadowing your boys make sure that there's not a lot about that, but you know, making sure they don't smoke in the woods or something.
I was just making sure they didn't do what we did in the woods, but go on.
Yeah, I'm going to get to your
but let's talk about that for a minute. They went for 8 weeks. I would go for 2 or 3 weeks, and you know, I never stayed the whole time. But I did go. And you know, I love camp. I love community. When my sister and I went to Camp Agwaac in 1963, Rick, our parents put us on an overnight train. No cell phones, nothing.
Oh, of course.
My sister, you know, and we are just so, you have a daughter. I mean, can you even imagine right now? Goodbye. You know, so we went on an overnight train. We didn't know anyone. And one of the things that I'll never forget is I slept on the top berth, and she slept on the bottom. And we used to say to each other, good night and pleasant dreams, good night and pleasant dreams. Mm-hmm. And I thought, where are we? And I dangled my arm over the side of the berth, and we touched fingers until we fell asleep. But, you know, I just remember waving to Mommy and Daddy through the darkened, dusky window, and I think they went to Europe the next day.
I said, we don't have kids. You went there, though. You did. You admit to going there with your teddy bear, Zelda. I want to know whatever happened to Zelda.
Oh, I wish we were on Zoom, because I'm looking at her.
You have her still?
Oh, of course.
See, Iris,
Rick,
what impressed
this
me...
whole book is about history holders.
It is.
I mean,
But you know, the remarkable thing about the book, and you do pepper the book with interviews with some of your campmates, short kind of lively interviews. But there's something, you come away from this book, if I do, feeling that your experience at camp and the experience of your friends, girls at camp, was almost utopian.
Right. I'm going to address the girls that I went to camp with, who are now in their 50s and 60s and 70s, are people that form a continual timeline in my life,
sure,
like my family does. So, you know, we go to elementary school, and then we go to high school, and then we go to college, and we make sequential sets of friends. Camp, I mean, you're together when you have your first everything, you know, you're 8 years old,
yeah,
you're 10, you're 15, you know, you're
arguably your most easily impressed time. And when it works out, it's when you learn, it's the same time you learn to like write cursive. I mean, some things stay with you forever. Iris, we got to take a break. We're going to come back. I'm going to read one last thing before we take a break. Iris writes again in her Camp Girls book, talk of traditional foods and summer camp schedules may seem insignificant in the face of the woes of the world. And you wrote this a couple of years ago before the woes really intensified.
Mm.
Yet it is the power of these ordinary and restorative routines that even out the rest of our lives. Truer words have never been written. We'll be right back with Iris Krasnow. For any of you people out there who went to summer camp, you will be delighted and thrown back to your own past by reading Iris Krasnow's Camp Girls, Fireside Lessons on Friendship, Courage, and Loyalty. She's a terrific writer. The camp was Agwaac or something. What's the name of it? Is that it, Agwaac?
It still is.
Yes, it is. It is like many, many, many other camps across the country.
Yes, it's in closed. A little hiatus.
Yeah, and you do some little interesting stuff with history of camps, and you know, I would not have known that there were nearly 2,400 camps accredited by the American Camp Association, and that those camps banned technology, and I couldn't be happier about that for little
Rick,
little girls I will never meet.
Yeah, well, you know, you brought up before the break about utopia. It's not utopia. It is a place where you're thrust on your own, away from mommy and daddy for the first time. And if you like it, some people hate camp and they go 1 year. You know, I interviewed a lot of people for this book.
Yeah.
And some people I'd call and I'd say, I know you went to camp. And they'd say, I hated it. I only stayed a year. But for repetitive summers, if you kept going, the core qualities that really sustain you and can form the spine of a successful adulthood, such as independence and versatility and, you know,
and
responsibility.
And competitiveness. I mean, you're pretty good here.
Ambition, 100%, 100%. You know, I remember my first job interview in Chicago. The only experience I had been a waitress and a camp counselor.
Yes,
and
but then you went up and you interviewed with the amazing Margie Korshak, who ran a public relations agency, and you found out that her daughter had attended your camp.
My camp. I know it was kismet. Her daughter, Susie, went to our camp. You know, I have four sons and one husband and two male cats. And so for me, it's also this time for girl power and to really be surrounded by. But the best of who I am and the most mischievous of who I am, and really my ability, I think, to parent and mm-hmm. to be a good friend, all that came from these early years flung into a cabin of strangers. And uh-huh. you said it seems utopian. It is not utopian. You know, you get picked on, you pick on others. You can't call mommy and say, take care of this. You portage heavy canoes, you know, through torrential rainforest.
I know it sounds.
And may I say also, you know, it's not only the myth is that it's a certain kind of girl or boy that can go to camp. The truth is, all the studies show whether you go to a Boy Scout camp or a Girl Scout camp for 1 week or 2 weeks, the takeaway is those character traits I just listed are almost the same. If you're sleeping in a tent away from your parents for the first time, or if you're in a cabin in the woods. So the takeaway is those central character traits that make us whole and that really, for me, that are sustaining me through this really difficult time in life, you know?
I also find, I use the word utopian, Iris, only in a kind of retrospective kind of way, because yes, it was, I'm sure it was hard to carry.
It was a simpler
I've never carried a canoe through the forest, and I'm sure it was brutal for you. But I mean, comparatively, the lives we lead now, to fall back into the past, most of the memories, even of difficult things, take on a rather pleasant hue. And that is what I really got from your book, that as difficult as some of this stuff was, you now realize how empowering and enriching all of it was. I want to get I need to get to this one point, because this book is a very honest book. And at one point, and you really are empowered, whenever you write, as a child, I returned from Camp Brown and muscled, holding my lanyards and trophies and so much love. I would tell my parents, I can do anything. But then, later on in the book, you lie to your parents. You fell in love, or lust, as you say, with a guy the first night of counselor summer camp. Dates meant leaving the bar together and heading for the woods. In a letter home, I just love this because it's so honest. In a letter home, I wrote vaguely of my summer love. Dear Mom and Dad, I met the man of my dreams this summer. Ha! Don't worry. He is Jewish. The next sentence is, he was a Christian Scientist.
I was a counselor, so just let's clear this up. I wasn't 10, okay?
Oh, no, you weren't 10. No, you were an adult. You
right,
were,
okay.
Yeah, you were 18. Yeah. Oh, yes. No, this is not a 10-year-old romance.
Yeah.
No.
Let's clear that one up.
Yes. You were 18, and he was 24. And this is a lovely, funny, there are a lot of amusing parts of the book. This is a funny one. When you go out to visit him, he turns out he's not the Robert Redford of that he was at the camp. He turns out to be kind of the Woody Allen of Nebraska, and you turn around and leave him there. Iris, was this
at the airport? Yeah, right.
And the interesting thing about Minocqua, I will have you know, was where the summer home was of the most notorious alderman in the history of Chicago, Matthias Paddy Bowler, who once said, Chicago ain't ready for reform. Only I would know that.
But that's a really good tidbit. Lanuk was beautiful.
Oh, I know. I've been up there. I was up there.
Yeah, it's so beautiful, but my friends are reporting, you know, the townies who live there say it's almost if nobody realizes there's a, this is not funny, but a pandemic. You know, the bars are crowded.
Sure.
It's opened up a lot. And, when I see that sign that says Minocqua, 3 miles, 1 mile, you know, my whole girlhood shoots through me.
Now
and,
you know... What do you hear?
Go on.
I know you interviewed many of them from this book, and they all seem like in the interviews delightful, accomplished, and introspective, thoughtful people. What have you heard from others? You must have heard, even in this crazy time, from others who said, "Oh my God, that was exactly what camp was like for me. I am who I am because of camp."
Well, I would say that many of my friends have gone into public service. You know, many of my friends went to camp and became counselors, and we just learned to live in a community and to really help each other and to empower each other. Another thing I love about camp, you know, well, first of all, no technology, so you have to make friends in real time. You know, you're not linked. You're not out posting each other on Instagram. You know, these girls, they are hugging for real. They are dressed pretty much alike. But what I'm hearing, well, I'll tell you a story. An 85-year-old woman reached out to me when she found out that I was doing this book.
Yeah.
And she started talking to me, and she said, you know, I was the best canoer at Camp Agawak, and, you know, I can still get in a boat, and I was the best fisherwoman. And she said to me, you know, I've been all over the world. I've been to Africa. I've been to Iceland. I've been to Israel. I've been to Antarctica. I've been everywhere in the world. I've been to Nepal. But when I want to go to sleep at night, I close my eyes, and I picture myself in a little rowboat on Blue Lake with my fishing pole in the water. And I feel so powerful, and I still think about that. She said, you know, I may be in my 80s, but once a camp girl, always a camp girl. I think it really forms the roots of a life.
You very, Iris Kresno, you very artfully lovingly make that case. You have written, you will find bits and pieces of Iris's own biography, a sort of part memoir. You will learn of her mother being a Holocaust survivor. You will learn that I think, I'm not sure that your experiences in Minocqua led you to the place you live now, but there are certain similarities between the place you live now. I mean, you were drawn to nature. You're an Oak Park girl, but you were drawn to nature through that camp experience, weren't you?
Well, Oak Park was full of trees, and it
yes,
was
I know it's full. It so is Lincoln Park. Yeah, I know.
I know.
It's
love
not the North Woods, though.
I know. But I like. I mean, from that experience of towering trees and just having space to think and talk about writing in the woods, your whole soul opens up. There's no fluorescent lights. There's no steely gaze of a teacher with a red pen. I mean, my girls, when I teach my writing activity, I give them lined yellow pads and pens, and I give them a theme like friendship or respect or, you know, equality, and then they just write every week. We have a magazine reading every week. And these girls and their moms, they say, and then I have them write letters home, and the moms say to me, this is the first time I've seen my child's handwriting.
Oh.
You know, it's computer printouts. And so there's something really raw and real and primal and basic about the experiences that we have and so lucky to have. I mean, I know how fortunate I was. In 1963, 8 weeks at Camp Agawak, I think it cost $750.
$1,500 for you and your sister. Yeah. And some are expensive now. I've known a lot of young ladies over the years who went to camp, but you also make the case that there are a lot of organizations that are in the business of sending underprivileged or girls whose families do not have a lot of money to camp, too. Iris, this is really an impressive book, and I told you before I went into it with a bit of trepidation and read it because you're a friend of mine. But it's charming. It's really, really charming, and you make a very interesting case for the value of being a camp girl. And you will be, the new hours are coming next week, but I'm hoping you will make a journey to Chicago for a few book events whenever the world loosens up and
I've been
calmer.
Zooming.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, yeah, I'll find you. And thank you. I mean, it really was a passion project.
No question.
And, you know, and I really appreciate being able to talk about it because these times that we're living in right now, you know, it's a little ray.
Well, I think it's a way for, and I also think it's a way for people to return. It will evoke for women of a certain age a gentler past. Iris, it's great to talk to you, honey.
Thank you,
care of yourself.
Be well.
And
you take care of yourself
and your
daughter.
Don't bug your grown sons, okay?
I don't.
Yeah,
I never do.
Don't go to camp with them. Don't go to their offices and bring them lunch. Don't do stuff like that.
It's Rick. They're all here right now. Everybody's quarantined here.
Okay, so. Boys, I've just told your mom to leave you alone. Let you grow.
And you know what? I'm going to. I am going to. I promise. After I pick their wives, it's going to be just all over.
Take care, Iris. Lovely to talk to you.
You.
All right, sweetie.
Thank you.
See ya. We'll be back in a couple minutes with the one and only Tony Fitzpatrick. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Hogan. If you've been out and about these last few nice days and the nice days coming out, you might have seen my friend Tony Fitzpatrick with his gang in Humboldt Park. They go there with some regularity to feed the birds. This is a sort of, Tony loves birds, but it's one of his new activities. I once went with them, and it was a joy. Tony, did you go to the park today?
Yeah, I went. I went, and, you know, the geese, they know me by sight now. They come, Rick, they haul ass across the lagoon, because it's like, here comes Fat Jesus, you know, and they just... some of them will literally come out of the water and step
You should tell your wife, Michelle, that you would like to have some of them come over to the house. Wouldn't that be a good idea? But it is,
yeah.
Tony. She'd be all over that. People have made adjustments. These are, and Tony is about articulate and feeling a person about this, as I know. These are the toughest times that you and I, my contemporary friend, have ever been through, is it not?
Absolutely.
I get dizzy.
I've made it a point to keep a diary of this period. And every once in a while, I look through it because I'm going to include it in the next book, like the last third of the book. And I'm like, boy, it's written by a guy who just does not know what's next. And that's part of the, you know, niggling kind of fear, but also kind of excitement about it. It's like, okay, well,
what's next?
You have to find a way to, you know, survive it economically, emotionally.
Let's talk about that for a second. I mean, one thing, both of your galleries in Chicago closed. You've closed your studio. Tony
in my studio,
Tony's one of the great visual artists of our time, and collected by a number of people, and collected by people who just want a piece of Tony Fitzpatrick's distinctive, incredibly distinctive artwork. And you close that, and you're sitting at home with your wife and your two lovely kids, and an idea hatches, basically, from your wife, Michelle, who has always been on you to, hey, and as I've told you, I've written about you, I hate jigsaw puzzles. Now, hate may be too strong a word, but I don't like jigsaw puzzles.
Well,
but you don't either.
I'm perplexed by them, Rick, because I've never finished. You know,
that just means you're dumb.
I can make incredibly complex drawings and pictures. But jigsaw puzzles require a certain kind of logic and problem-solving ability that I just am afraid is not really in my toolbox. But
you were not reluctant to take Michelle's advice and sort of,
I mean, I was sitting in Humboldt Park, and I'm like, wow, I no longer have an income.
Yeah.
You know, what am I going to do? And, you know, so she'd kind of been after me about this for a while. So we made some jigsaw puzzles, and, you know, and at first we just made a few hundred just to see if they'd fly, and... Yeah.
Well, you made
they sold out in like 16 minutes.
Yeah, you made that was the thing. Well, that's a good example of a business idea whose time has come. You make 300 puzzles; they're priced very reasonably at $20-$30 or something, and 300 of them sold and via an online. It wasn't like you had a puzzle stand in the middle of Humboldt Park.
No, and I mean
online,
you couldn't.
They
you
sold
know?
in 15 minutes. They were all gone.
Yeah, my son called me up from upstairs. He was watching the
news,
the Shopify on the computer, you know, and he said, "Dad, you know the puzzle sold out." I said, "Well, you know which one?" He goes, "All of them." And so, you know, we re-upped and we ordered more this time, and those sold out even faster. So now we have there's a bunch more coming any day now, and. And one of the great joys of the thing is that people have been sending me shots via social media of themselves working on the puzzles and working with their families on the puzzles. And I read this great article that somebody sent me from The Nation or Atlantic, one of them, about the value of jigsaw puzzles.
Oh, yeah.
They give people, they help people de-stress, and they give them a surmountable task that help them engage in problem solving
and a sense of accomplishment too with something that is beautiful, because your artwork is beautiful.
You'd be surprised who likes these. You know, our friend Esther J. Cepeda.
Who?
I drove up Esther
I
J.
know.
Cepeda.
Yeah.
I drove up to Madison to give her a puzzle, you know. And, you know, Mayor Lightfoot has been stressing, please socially distance, you know. And
yeah.
I think it's a really important, you know, and especially now that we're kind of reopening, I'm definitely afraid of a second spike that's even more ominous. So what I've been doing is handing off the puzzles on a pizza peel, you know, a pizza paddle.
As you did for me at the corner of Michigan and Chicago. Tony jumps out of a car, and I go, "What is this? It looks like he's going to, you know, hit me, spank me with this big paddle." And instead he delivers a puzzle that was destined for my daughter Fiona. But you've done that a number of times, haven't you? Who gets a special delivery?
I've done it a whole bunch. I mean, and to the point of where people are like, "Can you deliver it on the pizza panel?" You know, and it's like, and honestly, it's become like a marvelous kind of distraction for me as well. I mean, and the idea that they seem to genuinely make people happy. I mean, for me, they're an exercise in frustration. It's like my son Max and his girlfriend and Gabby finished one in a couple of days, you know, and I have a genius niece named Olivia.
Wait, I don't think you have to be a genius to finish a jigsaw puzzle.
Yeah, but she finished a 1,000-piece one of the Watchman of Perilous Chase, the owl, in like 6 hours.
That's pretty good.
And nobody I've talked to has, you know, a lot of people haven't even finished it yet.
Yeah.
So I'm really happy that they're kind of challenging, and I think I know why. I mean, a lot of puzzles are like from photographs or from old paintings,
and they follow a
certain pictorial logic. Yeah, this unfortunately follows Tony logic, which is like hitting the head with a bat. You know, they've proven to be more challenging than I thought, but it's become like a kind of a marvelous thing in our life, you know.
Well, it's become a cottage industry. I know how you ordered 300 at first, then you ordered 4,000. What's the next order that you put in?
Well, this one is this is like 3,800, you know. So
yeah,
I think you know, they'll sell very well. I mean, now with people able to go out and stuff, maybe not as quickly, but you know, we'll be able to let some of our wonderful friends who are retailers have some.
Neat.
You know, the bookseller in Lincoln Square is going to have them, and we love those guys.
Yeah, no,
you know,
kidding. When do you think, Tony, that you might be able to reopen your studio and your galleries?
You know, I don't know, yeah. and I want to err on the side of caution.
Sure.
Because you've been to our openings. I mean, you know.
Oh, they're crowded.
And,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, they get really crowded. And I wouldn't be able to live with myself if somebody got sick because of one of our openings.
Yeah.
So it's a really kind of perplexing thing. You know, I mean, I have a museum show opening October 3rd at the Cleve Kearney Museum and College of DuPage. And I honestly think it's probably not going to be like any other
show you've ever had.
I've ever had.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe they'll let a certain amount of people in at the same time and, you know, but all socially distanced. But, yeah, this has been an incredibly challenging, stressful, and, you know, kind of life-changing time.
We talk a lot, but I never asked you, does it frighten you? This
you know
disease?
What? The last couple of weeks have frightened me. And it has very little to do with COVID-19.
Yeah, yeah.
I cannot get the image of George Floyd's murder out of my head.
Very few people can. I mean, it kind of, you know, I want you after the commercial break to read an essay. Tony is also a terribly talented writer, and he wrote columns for New City for a while. He's written fabulous dramas in collaboration with Ann Filmer at the 16th Theater. But he's a man.
We're working on another one right now, in fact.
He is a man who likes to share his opinion, and he does it artfully. I don't want you to swear when you read it. I only found one.
No. Rick, I made it.
Yeah, you've been on the radio
friendly.
You've been on the radio a million times.
Yeah.
But that is how you, I know you love to talk too, as do I, but writing is a different form for you of kind of gathering your thoughts. Is it not? I mean, writing is important beyond.
Yeah. I mean, especially during this, I always knew that the diary, I was never going to, like, you know, hide it under my pillow or anything like that. I always knew it was going to be public.
Sure.
But it's a chance to kind of think out loud. And, and you know, I mean, the thing that I keep trying to underline is that the pandemic and the horror of the last couple of weeks, a great much of this, I think, could have been avoidable. You know, I mean, incredibly avoidable. Had we lived under a different political age and different national leadership, I cannot not think that. And
given I have read your essay, and given that, and given your feelings about the man who sits in the White House, are you worried about the upcoming election? I know, and correct me if I'm wrong, I know you are not, as I am not, rabidly behind Joe Biden. I mean, it's a lesser of two.
You know what? Joe Biden is, you know, a grilled cheese sandwich. He's not delightful like a filet mignon or an Italian beef dipped with peppers. But sometimes when the world's heart is at its iciest, a grilled cheese is like the perfect thing. It gets us to whatever's next.
Given that, and you bring that up in your essay, given that, who was a president who was an Italian beef sandwich, a dipped Italian beef sandwich or filet mignon in your mind throughout the history of this country?
Boy, I sure liked Senator Sanders. I liked him until the point when I realized that there was a certain unbending and unwillingness to compromise. And, you know, I mean, politicians always like to paint themselves as these tough, uncompromising guys. When you realize the greatest achievements in politics have come because of a certain amount of compromise.
Sure, sure.
You know, the last thing you need is someone that is unbending.
Yeah, I
when,
get it.
When,
yeah.
You know, of the Democrats, I mean, the one thing I'm grateful about with Biden is he knows how the sausage is made.
Yeah, that's
you know, he's been
he
doing
better,
this for a long, long time.
He better know how the sausage is made. Okay,
And I think he's changed, you know. I mean, I think the Biden that you knew, you know, from the Anita Hill trial,
yeah, no
I think that guy does not exist anymore. I mean,
sure.
I think he's evolved. I think he's, I also think he's probably got the best consigliere in American politics and former President Obama.
All right, who do you think, before we break, and then you're going to come back and read your essay, who do you think you should pick for as a vice presidential running mate? He says he will do so on August 1st.
Honestly?
No, I want you to lie to me. Yes, honestly.
No. Val Demings, Stacey Abrams, or Andrew Cuomo.
Wow, Andrew Cuomo. Okay, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Tony Fitzpatrick is on the phone. We're going to take a short commercial break. We're going to come back. He's going to read his essay, which is a tough, you know, it's a political essay. Tony has opinions. Everybody has opinions.
Yep.
Not everybody gets to voice them to thousands of listeners. But Tony, it's Tony's lucky night. Tony, hey, and I didn't tell you, this show is in the future going to be on from 7 to 9, which I think is a much more civilized kind of time slot. And maybe one day
right?
They will.
You can get off at 9 and get to the saloon before last call.
That's true, because the last call at the Palm over there is 11, and you have to kind of flirt with the waitress to even get a drink at 11. We'll be right back with Tony Fitzpatrick. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Cogan. It is now my distinct pleasure to reintroduce Tony Fitzpatrick and allow him. Tony, talk before you read the essay. What was it? Was there a specific seed of this essay, a specific event, a specific catalyst that got you?
Yeah, it in very short order, it stopped being so much about the pandemic as it was about the murder of George Floyd.
All right, kiddo, read away.
Our nation and our city is having its weeks-long dark night of the soul. The aftermath of the horrifying murder of George Floyd has been a lesson to white America that centuries of aggression visited upon black lives will not any longer be tolerated. I've made myself a promise to shut up and listen more. I can't speak for black Americans, nor is it my place to. I can only attempt to be equal to the moment and absorb the lessons we must learn. This I will do. It's hard to listen to people who are yelling and screaming about looting and crimes against property without wondering if they're equally as horrified at the murder of Mr. Floyd. If the former is more concerning to them, they really need to work on themselves. For over 8 minutes and 46 seconds, three law enforcement officers stood by and watched while Mr. Floyd's life was extinguished in the most cruel and vile way imaginable. I have no doubt this officer's intent was to kill this man, especially after one of the policemen suggesting turning Mr. Floyd onto his side after failing to find a pulse. It was as chilling and as calculated as anything ever filmed. And the electronic media also took a salacious and leering pride and replaying this murder over and over and over until it was no longer breaking news, but the pornography of grief. Of course, this brutality is exactly what our national leadership entreats and winks at. Trump repeatedly encourages law enforcement to knock him on their ass. Knock him right in the head. Don't be too gentle. For he is a garden variety bully. One night this week, despite being behind several layers of heavily armed policemen and Secret Service, the tough guy ran to his bunker. He then complained about the condition of it, saying Obama neglected it. Here's a news flash. President Obama never spent any time cowering in the bunker. All of what has transpired in the last 2 weeks can be laid at Trump's doorstep. His brazen and unrepentant racism has struck an ugly chord in white America. It has provided yet another scapegoat for the Trump base. You're unhappy and you lack opportunity because of black Americans. Sadly, this is a narrative that will play at the ballot box. His continual race baiting and the uptick of the militarization of American police is truly draconian and frightening in its current manifestation. His threat to send the armed forces into police American cities in violation of posse comitatus is an indicator of just where this presidency is headed. You see, he admires strongmen and dictators, and if you paid attention, you realize that these are the only creeps he considers good company in the stage of world diplomacy. His creature, Attorney General William Barr, gave the go-ahead to open fire on American citizens with rubber bullets and tear gas, so that Bunker Boy could cross the street and wave a Bible around for cameras in front of a church. In the meantime, millions of Americans took to the streets. Demonstrations, which in large part were peaceful, in the middle of a pandemic, to protest the murder of George Floyd. And when the sun went down, the brutality raged. Cops swung on protesters with abandon like wild animals, often utilizing rubber bullets and tear gas, and protesters were often infiltrated by provocateurs, white supremacists, and opportunistic looters. Know this, the protesters protested, and the looters looted. One fears this is but a preview of what is to come if Trump loses in November, and he will lose. After dividing this country so completely that whole communities, organizations, and even families no longer trust each other, his strategy is chaos, division, and distraction. And he has succeeded. We are creeping up on an ominous number. The number of American fatalities that will soon be greater than the number of Americans who were killed in World War I due to COVID-19. 115,000. The statistic boggles the mind when one realizes just how avoidable it could have been had Trump, out of pique, not defunded the Center for Disease Control 2 years ago, merely to undo the Obama administration's funding of this world-respected medical entity. Had he not withdrawn from the World Health Organization, had he not insisted that COVID-19 was a Democratic hoax as late as late February, had there been adequate quarantines and testing from the get-go, everything this administration did was wrong and it cost scores of American lives. A great many of them, ironically, people who supported Donald Trump. The more one watches this administration, the more one realizes just how easily fascism has made itself quite comfortable in our republic. Barr, McConnell, Pence, Miller. This president and his Vichy-inspired enablers and creatures, a cabal of monsters to be sure, taking us down a dark and awful path. They're leading us back to the void of despair, the great nothing. So, my friends, you must vote, if only as an act of self-defense. Am I thrilled with Joe Biden? Not especially. But for now, he will do. Like I said before, Joe is like a grilled cheese sandwich. Not delightful like an Italian beef or a filet mignon or a really good ribeye at Gibson's, but he will do. Sometimes when the world is at its coldest and its very heart is solid ice, a grilled cheese is a perfect thing. It gets us to whatever's next and hopefully better. Change is coming, and it is necessary. Will it be fair? History tells us it is almost not ever fair, and that is the human experience. There will be right, and there will be wrong, and there will be the consequences of each. There is a lesson here for white America, and it is way past time. As the comedian Dave Chappelle said, right now the American streets are speaking for themselves. Shut up and listen.
Thank you, Tony Fitzpatrick. I'm sure there are some of those out there who disagree with you, but that's what life is all about, to hear...
And that's what makes a horse race, pal.
I know, to hear other opinions. I would recommend, thank you for that, I would recommend that people find on YouTube that Dave Chappelle 8-minute routine. It is
called 8:46.
It is remarkable. And also, if you're screwing around on the internet, find the 60-minute segment that they did tonight on the riots, the fatal riots in Tulsa. Tony, it is always good to talk to you. I will talk to you soon, not on
Likewise,
the radio, okay?
My friend.
Love to the family.
Take care, pal.
All right, love
Be
to
well.
The family. Tony is Tony. There's no doubt about that. We will be talking after the commercials and news at 10 to Dan McGrath, the former newspaper man who for the last decade has been running Leo High School on the South Side. Welcome back to After Hours with me, Rick Cogan. This show will be airing from 7 to 9 o'clock starting next Sunday and forever after. Or until the world goes totally crazy. There are very few newspaper people I have admired more than Dan McGrath as a writer and as an editor. And when he sort of left the business to devote himself to his alma mater, Leo High School on Southwest Side, mostly South Side, I couldn't have been more excited for him. He told, at the time... he told our mutual friend and great columnist, Rick Morrissey, he said, I don't want to sound all field of dreams, but it felt like a calling. It felt like at this time in my life, this is something I could do and maybe I should do. Dan McGrath, welcome to the show, and you must be very happy that you did make that decision, yes?
How are you, Rick? It's great to
talk with you, and
I hope you're all right.
I'm all right, but I'm confused. The world is whipping me around as if I'm on some kind of merry-go-round. I'm sure the same is true for you, too.
Oh, boy. It's been a challenging year, but... this is my 10th year, hard to believe. When I went into it, I had no idea how long it would be. I didn't give myself any sort of a timetable. I just said that I'm going to try this. I think I can be of some service, and I'll go for as long as I feel I have the energy. And because if I didn't have the energy to devote myself to it full time, then I'd be cheating the kids, and I would never want to.
Dan, give me a snapshot. Give me a snapshot of what Leo was like. You graduated in 1968. What
Correct.
Was Leo High School like in the mid-60s? Because it's vastly different than it is today.
Oh, for sure. We had 1,000 boys. I think we may have dipped below 1,000 when I was there because... that's when the neighborhood started to change.
Yes, exactly.
Over time, 79th Street acquired somewhat of an unsavory reputation, mm-hmm. and guys got squeamish about sending their sons. And they also had alternatives because the Irish Christian Brothers, they opened Leo in 1926, but mm-hmm. then they opened Brother Rice, and they also operated St. Lawrence. So there were three Irish Christian Brothers schools, and I think a lot of the alums felt, I can send my son to Brother Rice or St. Lawrence, and he'll get the same education. So our enrollment gradually really declined
precipitously. By the time you came there in 2010, there were a little less than 200 boys.
Yes, sir.
And there was
we knew some lean times.
And it was all black at that time?
Yeah, we've had a smattering of whites here and there. This year we've got a couple of mixed race kids, and we have four or five Hispanics. But we are probably 98% African American, and we have been for some time. You know, we've made overtures. We've tried to connect with some of the old parishes in Beverly and on the southwest side, and it just hasn't happened. And that's fine. We are who we are, and I remember I came back, and I was still in California in 1993, and I came back for my 25th reunion.
Yeah.
And there was talk then that we were going to relocate to Orland Park.
Sure.
There were some
I remember that.
Real estate speculators out there who were going to, you know, line up the land. And in a sense, it made sense. There's
well, because that's where a lot Catholic of that's where a lot of families in the south side moved after.
Tell me about
Of course,
when I first moved back, I'd look in the papers and you know Orland Park or Sandburg and New Lenox. All the athletes were McGuire and O'Hara. And I said, wait a minute, right. These are our guys.
That's right. Wait, those are Leo kids. What are you doing? They're Leo kids.
But it there was nothing. You know, Providence Catholic is in New Lenox and Marist is in the very far southwest fringes of Chicago, and there was nothing in between. So in some respects, maybe a Catholic school in Orland Park made sense.
Let me ask you,
Dan. It didn't have to be Leo.
Let
it should not have been Leo, I mean.
What seemed to have happened, because I do want to talk about your remarkable effort to reconnect some alums with the school. But for a time, I think, when the neighborhood started to get a little disheveled, for lack of a better word, and alums would not... I think there was a sort of tendency to say, well, okay, Leo's going to die. That's where I went to high school. My son's going to go to a nice new school. That there was some kind of real disconnect with some of the alums, and it was sort of a school that kind of was very, very sick, and it was going to die, and we'll move on. Do you think that makes any sense?
Yeah, it's a difficult concession to make, Rick, but I also think it's true. We're very blessed now to have Shaka Rawls as our principal. He's a Leo grad.
Oh, I want to talk about that kid.
Yeah.
That kid seemed... Well,
he's
that
a much
kid...
younger fellow than I am, but he's exactly what we needed. I met him my first year on the job. He would come up for alumni days or career days or anything we needed him for, he would be there. And I just saw how he interacted with the kids. I saw how genuine his enthusiasm was, and just a charismatic guy, and the kids responded to him really well. And I said to myself, I've got to get this guy in the building.
Yeah.
And it took me a while, but eventually we were able to do it. And in the 4 years he's been our principal, the enrollment has gone up 46%.
That is astonishing.
It is. It's because in the Catholic schools, if you're not losing, you're gaining. And we are legitimately gaining.
No question.
And he's changed the culture, too. I think the kids feel good about being there. Their parents feel good about having them there. So we're getting a good word of mouth in the communities that we serve. And, you know, this last quarter was rough. I think it was rough for everybody.
Sure.
But we got an online learning and platform in place right away, and the kids took to it, the teachers took to it, and I think we were able to maintain a pretty strong educational focus.
But the other thing that happened at Leo, for a time, I think it was kind of an oasis where the kids going there knew it was a safe haven. I once did a story out there many years ago, Dan, where I was doing some story about gang graffiti, and I drove by Leo and went in and said, "Why do you have no gang graffiti here? What's the deal?" Well, you know, a lot of the people in the gangs, their younger brothers go here, and so they leave us alone.
True.
No, and it was striking, but
yeah.
It was sort of now since you've come there, not only has it remained a kind of safe haven, it has done a lot of interesting kind of community outreach, not in the kind of knee-jerk way that a lot of private schools do it, but in a really substantive kind of way to make I think the kids who come from all different sorts of places feel that, yes, they are a safe haven when they're in there, but they are part of this larger community, which is part of this larger city.
Yeah, we kind of work at that. You know, I think we've created a feeling that, you know, we're not for everybody, but if you're here, you know, you really have an opportunity to do something with yourself when you leave here, whether it's college or the workforce or the military or whatever it is you choose you want to do. When you leave here, you'll be ready for it. So while you're here, you know, take advantage. There's some real opportunities here. You're going to learn some things. You're going to meet some people. You're going to be exposed to some things that you wouldn't necessarily experience in your neighborhood. And you'll be a well-rounded young man. So take advantage of those opportunities, and, you know, you'll be on your way. And we've graduated 100% of our seniors. This will be the 10th year in a row.
Is that right?
And, yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. And,
wow.
It's a lot of commitment by a lot of people.
Oh, it's hard
work. A lot
work.
Of the alums.
Sure.
The alums are still fantastically, even after they stopped sending their sons, Rick,
yeah.
They continued to support us financially, which is
a great Chicago story. I want to use as an example the famous Hessian brothers.
Oh, two of the best
back,
we've ever
when
had.
When we come back
sure.
after a short commercial break, because I don't know a lot of other alums. Ever so often I'll run into somebody and say, where'd you go to high school? I was a Leo kid. We'll take a short commercial break and come back with Dan McGrath and also talk about what it has been like and how, you know, when you talk about Black Lives Mattering, the Black lives of the kids who go to Leo High School matter tremendously to Dan McGrath and all the other people who teach at that school. We'll be right back.
Did you know Geico's now offering an extra 15% credit on car and motorcycle policies? That's 15% on top of what Geico could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Your baby to let you sleep in?
What? We could sleep in another half hour? Thanks, sweetheart. And you'll change yourself, too?
There's never been a better time to switch to Geico. Save an extra 15% when you switch by October 7th. Limitations apply. Visit geico.com for details.
Attention, business owners. With the coronavirus and so many other contaminants polluting our air, the challenges of staying healthy and productive can feel overwhelming. Millhouse Engineering and Construction solves problems that improve communities everywhere. They use a special fog sanitization to effectively sanitize against the coronavirus. Maximize the productivity of your staff with peace of mind. You'll know you've taken precautions to provide a healthy work environment. Millhouse's sanitization fogging is the same process recently adopted by the major airlines. It filters the air with a 3-stage HEPA filtration system and uses a hospital-grade EPA-registered solution for fogging. Unlike other processes, their solution doesn't use bleach or leave a toxic residue. Their sanitizing fog combats contaminants in the air and on hard, soft, and porous surfaces. To sanitize the air against coronavirus and other contaminants in your office, call Millhouse Engineering right now for a consultation at 855-621-0001. That's 855-621-0001 or millhouseinc.com.
If the last several months cooped up on your kitchen left you longing for more workspace, efficiency, or just an updated style that inspires, then it's time and okay to get out of that kitchen and over to Builder Supply Outlet. They're open for business Monday through Saturday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., taking every precaution to ensure your safety, while their designers help create a space that you won't mind being confined to when you stay at home. Call 708-343-3900 to make an appointment or go to buildersupplyoutlet.com.
They're Chicago, and they're real. Watch Dan Ponce, Lauren Jiggins, Larry Potash, and Robin Baumgarten get real in the morning with the WGN-TV Morning News Team, weekdays 4 to 10.
You're listening to After Hours with me, Rick Kogan. We're talking with Dan McGrath, who has, for the last 10 years, run Leo High School on the southwest side near St. Sabina. I think Leo's at the 79th and Sangamon. Am I right? That's the corner, Dan?
Right.
Yeah.
And Sabina's at 77th and Racine.
Yeah.
So it's about four blocks.
One of the things, Leo, which for a variety of reasons there's a period where it was not getting the kind of press it once got. But the story of Leo High School is an astonishing one, and one that has gotten into and under the skin of generations of Chicagoans. Dan, I wonder if you, I remember you telling me the story of how you came there, and it's a very emotional story, and it involves your dad dying. Could you tell that story? I think it really goes to the heart of what that place in the mid-60s and before and now is to people.
Yeah, I don't like to, you know, over-dramatize or,
you know, I know you don't, but it's such an amazing story.
You know, my brother Jim is 3 years elder, my senior, and he went to Leo, and I went to St. Cajetan's, which is out near in Kennedy Park area around 113th and Western, and Leo wasn't a big feeder school for, right. or St. Cajetan's wasn't a big feeder school for Leo, but some guys went there, and my brother went there, and I kind of liked the idea of an older, more established place, so I took the entrance exam in eighth grade, and I took the test in January, and my father died in February, and we had seven kids, and my mom, I was right in the middle, I had three older and three younger. And my mom wanted us all in Catholic school, so we would have found a way to go. Back then, the tuition was, I think it was like $180 a year. It wasn't anything like it is now.
Yeah, but still.
So we would have found a way to do it. One of my uncles was going to help me. He wanted me to go to Brother Rice, but he said, I'll help you go to Leo. And then in May, a gentleman from the Alumni Association came by, and he said, we understand you had this rough thing happen, and we've checked you out. We think you'd make a pretty good Leo man. So if you still want to go to Leo, the Alumni Association will sponsor you. And they did. They paid all 4 years. And again, it wasn't a whole lot of money, but it was one fewer thing for my mother to worry about.
Well, it was the altruistic gesture that has always gotten me. You must have told me that story 20 years ago at the Billy Goat, and
I thought you were going to say 20 times, which I probably have to.
Well, sometimes we do tend to go on at the Billy
Goat.
No, I think only one time. It has stayed with me forever, in large part because I got to know Jack and Bill Hessian, who were both graduates of Leo, and both
were
incredibly fond of it. Jack, who died some time ago, and Bill, who recently died. And the story of talk about Bill's death, and I know that his daughter Katie and the rest of the family is really grateful for how Leo played a part in his recent death.
Oh, he was just the nicest man in the world. He was such a, he spent his entire life in education. You can think about the number of young lives he touched. And he was very loyal to Leo. He came to a lot of events. I think it was 2011 or 2012. We put him in the Hall of Fame, which was long overdue. He was a terrific athlete during his Leo days. And even at his advanced age, it still meant a lot to him to go into the Leo Hall of Fame. And, because of his experience in education, he really became sort of a confidant to me. I leaned on him a lot. And, he got sick over the summer and passed away just as the COVID restrictions were going into place. So his family couldn't give him the send-off that a proud old Irishman would deserve and want.
Yes.
But the neighbors, Katie put out the word that he was failing, and everybody knew Bill from walking his rescue dog around the neighborhood.
Yes.
And so Katie put out the word that he was failing. He probably didn't have much time left, and probably more than 100 people showed up underneath the balcony at his apartment to just wish him well. And Heidi Stevens wrote a lovely piece about it in the Tribune, and it was just what a way to acknowledge a really terrific guy.
He was with a Leo sweatshirt, too.
That's another story. A friend of the family was in the neighborhood. He was driving by on 79th Street, and he just stopped in. He said, I'm on my way to the Hessians. Maybe I could pick up something for Bill to cheer him up. So we gave him a sweatshirt, and he brought it, and they put it over Bill as he lay on his couch.
Yeah, that's
they took some pictures, and So he was a Leo man till the end, literally.
No kidding. He and Jack were just so fond of that place. And since you've come back in 2010, you have really reconnected. I mean, you've really worked hard to not just raise money and to increase the student body, but to remind alums of the value of Leo.
Well, it's valuable in that neighborhood, Rick. It's really, you know, we're a big part of that community. I would fear for that portion of 79th Street if we were to go. And it's also, you know, Bob Foster, who was my predecessor and did more than anybody to keep the place going, especially after the Irish Christian Brothers pulled out in the early 90s. It was Bob who devised the strategy to sort of put it on the alumni. But Bob said many times, probably as often as I told you the story about my hooking up with Leo, Bob said many times, you know, a mission doesn't change because neighborhood demographics change. And the first time I heard that, it really stuck with me. You know, Leo was always a working class school. It was our dads were cops and firefighters and tradesmen and we were, you know, primarily white ethnics, and now the school is predominantly African American, but it's still a blue collar working man's school, and we want the young guys coming up to have the same opportunities we had, or have similar opportunities to what we had. And I think that's one of the reasons why the alums have remained loyal. I think more than half the guys who work there are Leo graduates, including Mr. Rawls and myself.
Wow, that's great.
And I think we all feel that Leo helped us get off to a good start in life, and we want the young guys coming along to have this, you know, similar opportunities to what we had. So
you know, one of the problems, and you know, there are a million of them, but one of the, I would love to know, and I don't think you can know at this point, Dana, you know, during all, you know, everything shuts down because of the pandemic, and then George Flynn is murdered. And I am just, it isn't, if you can go in a classroom and talk to a bunch of young black students about how they felt about it, what do you think? And I know this is a very tough thing. What do you think those kids are thinking?
I think they're just wary. It's tough to be a young black man in America. It's tough to be a young black man in Chicago. And that's one of the areas where Shaka Rawls really excels, because he talks to the boys about that all the time. And he says, you got to do better. You've got to be better. You've got to, you know, you kind of start out in life with one strike against you, and you know, you've got to overcome that.
Yeah.
But he's also very, he preaches, this isn't either or. You know, if you're pro Black Lives Matter, it doesn't mean you're anti-police. Or
correct.
You're not pro-police and anti-Black Lives Matter. We're all human beings, you know, we're all people. And at the end of the day, we all just want to go home to our families.
Yep.
And he presses the concept of understanding. We had a community day a week ago Thursday, and it was phenomenal. We were wondering, that one weekend was really rough. There was a lot of looting in the neighborhood. Leo was spared. I think the building is set fairly far back from the street. It's a pretty secure, you know, it's a 96-year-old building with pretty good security, and
but I also think as it did a decade more ago when I was there, there is a kind of invisible shield around Leo, because what it has done, you know, there are a lot of kids who get pulled into the gangs, and they do not want their younger siblings pulled into the gang.
Well, that's a good point, and I idealistically, I think that's true. And, and we started passing out meals like the third week of March, not like within a week of the restrictions going in place. We had a meals giveaway set up, and we've been giving out meals twice a week, sometimes three times a week, since late March. And it started out primarily for our Leo families, but then we expanded it to the community.
Well, because you saw the need in the
for
community.
Sure. Heidi Stevens. I think that got us some good good juju as well. I do think we have a certain position in the neighborhood that people do respect us.
No,
you know, we work with the Auburn Gresham Neighborhood Development Corporation. We work with Father Flager. And everything we do, we try to enhance our sense of belonging in that community. I mean, we've been there 96 years.
Yeah, well, but as I said earlier, that is in the last decade, that has become a much more prominent aspect of Leo's residency, long residency in the city of Chicago. We got to take another break now. I'm going to come back and, you know, we're not straightening out the world, but I'm in talking to you, I feel more hopeful. We'll be back in a couple minutes. Welcome back. I'm having a discussion. Dan McGrath and I are trying to not save the world. We're just trying to understand the world. He is the he runs the Leo High School on the south and west enough on the south side. He is the president of Leo Husky. He's a former Tribune editor, former editor and writer at a number of papers, and one of the best sports minds in this country. I had a, just between us, I talked to our old friend Gregory Favre.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he's doing okay. He's doing okay. Gregory, also one of the giants of journalism.
Yes, we both had the privilege of working for him.
Oh, we sure did. I mean, we're talking about an inspiring guy who really... Yeah. Who really got, I think, what newspapers were when newspapers were newspapers.
Yeah, when I left San Francisco to go to Sacramento, and people looked at me like I needed my head examined. Why would you leave San Francisco for Sacramento? And the answer was I wanted to work for Gregory Favre.
Gregory Favre, yeah.
He turned out to be one of the better things I did in the business. I learned so much from him.
I was lucky to stumble into his realm at the Daily News in Chicago. What happens now, Dan? You know, there's no school. Are you planning for new classes in the fall?
Yeah, for sure. I think we should be okay because, you know, as I said earlier, the building was built for 1,000 boys.
Right.
About 210 this fall, which is our largest in about 15 years. But we'll be able to social distance, and we'll put up the plexiglass where it needs to be, and, you know, take great precautions in the cafeteria, take great precautions with our sports teams. We still don't know about sports because that's up to the IHSA, and that'll come from the governor. But we've been telling our parents that we expect to be open again in mid-August, and I think we will be. I think the Cardinal is going to give the Catholic schools the go-ahead.
I'm so happy to hear that. Explain to me, Dan McGrath, why Leo High School, with such a relatively small student body, has, I've noticed it, in the last few years, become a something of a... I'm going to say it, and you as a sports guy may say, oh, come on, Rick, we're not that. Something of a local sports powerhouse. You've had some great success in sports with a very small student body.
Yeah, football's tough because we just don't have the numbers. Yeah. And we play in the Catholic League with, you know, Mount Carmel and Loyola and all those powerhouses.
Good luck. Yeah.
But we're always going to be good in basketball. We're always going to be good in track. We're getting better in baseball. And then we offer wrestling, boxing, cross-country. We try to offer almost as much as any of our contemporaries do because we want, you know, everybody who comes to Leo, we want them to have an opportunity to excel at something or to find something that fits their interests. We have a lot of extracurriculars that aren't sports-related. And we probably only have 5 or 6 kids who come at 8 and leave at 3. Everybody's involved with something. And, you know, we've got data that shows the busier a kid is, the better he does academically. So we try to get everybody involved in something. We think it promotes camaraderie. We're lucky that we have very good coaches. And we don't have great facilities, but we have interesting facilities. Our gym is one of the
facilities
with character. Figures
facilities
on the south
with character.
For sure.
Where do you draw? The kids are not certainly all neighborhood kids, are they?
No. We've started to do better in the immediate area, but I think we had 21 zip codes this year, 23. Yeah, it's all over the south side and the close-in southwest burbs. what happened, you know, like Country Club Hills and Hazelcrest and Midlothian, we started to draw from down there. What happened is some of our younger alums have moved down there,
right,
and they're teaching, right, and coaching and, you know, running into kids that they consider good prospects. So we send a bus down there every morning, and we bring back about 24 kids from the close-in South Burbs. So that's been a good area for us. And then the rest of it is traditional Chicago.
You graduate 100% of the kids, which I find stunning these days in higher education. How many of them, are they all, and do you nurture college-bound?
We do.
Life?
We do.
Yeah. Where do they go? I mean, I'm sure it's all over the map.
Some HBCUs, Northern, Western, the state schools. We usually get two or three for U of I. We've gone to DePaul. We've got a young fellow going to DePaul. Not too much Marquette, despite my entreaties. We had a Purdue student a few years back, an engineering student who was one of the few African Americans in their aerospace program. He graduated in 5 years, and he's working for Google now. He's all over the world working for Google Maps.
Wow.
And every time I talk to him, I say, Edward, when do the checks start? He's doing very well at Google. But, you know, we also understand that college isn't for everybody. So
True.
We have good, we have relationships with some of the trade unions, the electricians and the plumbers. The electricians in particular, they have a pre-apprenticeship program
where you work as a laborer
for a few months, and you just get a handle on everything electricians do. And if you like it and they like you, at the end of this pre-apprenticeship program, you become an apprentice, and then you're on your way to a career as a journeyman electrician. And nowadays, that's probably better than a BA in history.
It's better than a job as a newspaper reporter, I'll tell you that.
At least you got a
future in those trades.
Yeah.
You know, something occurs to me, too. I know that your family, I remember, and tell me if I'm wrong, I know your dad was a cop. And
yes, he was.
And there are a lot of police officers, you know, maybe a nephew, and I know that you are kind of from a police family. And I was walking down Michigan Avenue on the way here, much of it still boarded up, and just stopped and talked to the cops on every corner. They got nothing to do, thank God, but there are cops on every corner. And I just said, how are you guys doing? And they said, well, these are rough times for us. These are rough times. And they did not mean, I think, that they were rough times of getting into action. They were rough times of a different sort. What are your thoughts about it's so early in this, you know, defund nonsense, which 99% of people don't even understand. But how do you, a cop's son, feel about cops these days?
Well, I agree. Defunding is total nonsense. Are we not going to have police? I think reappropriate is a more better term than, you know, more. And I've felt this for years, Rick. I'd like to see more more money and programs on the front end. You know, we spend a lot of money on incarceration and locking people up.
Yeah.
And I think if we did more to head kids off before they got into trouble, if we had more preventive measures for young kids and kept them out of trouble, and, you know, we'd be much better off if we caught it on the front end rather than waiting until, and then, you know, lock everybody up. And I think it's we tend to be a little militaristic. And,
well,
like, and
it tends to be a little, I mean, I've argued this for years, it tends to be a little racist, too, the whole war against,
against
drugs, for God's sake.
The police, I think, are bearing the brunt of the, racial disparity in this country is—it's not limited to the police, law enforcement, and the justice system. They might be the most visible symbol of it, or at least symbol of it. But
incendiary symbol.
Yeah, it's a much more widespread problem, and they just happen to be bearing the brunt of it right now. But Shaka and I agree that one of our messages is, you know, it's not an either or thing. If you're pushing advocating for Black Lives Matter, it doesn't necessarily mean you're anti-police.
Sure.
You want justice across the board. And, you know, when I see the, you know, the lack, Auburn Gresham is a food desert. I think there's probably four grocery stores that our people have access to.
Yeah.
Two of them were looted and two of them closed down to avoid the risk of looting.
Sure.
There's really very, very limited medical care. The there was a CVS at the corner of 79th and Halsted that went out of business about 3 months ago. Mm. And so our, you know, we try to be as full service as we can be, but there's a lot of lot of shortcomings. It's a very much an underserved community, and there's pockets like that all over the city. So I just like to see a better appropriation of resources.
Yeah, no kidding.
And I think you'd head off a lot of problems if you could do that. I think poverty and crime and joblessness all go together.
I do too. And I think, you know, when you have this, you know, 24-hour news cycle of everything that seems on the brink of disaster, the message gets muddled. The message,
right, and that's one of the reasons, you know, you asked me how our kids were feeling. I think they were legitimately concerned because, you know, loop after loop on TV is young Black guys running out of vandalized stores with stolen loot under their arms, and you could easily get the impression that, you know, every Black kid out there is either a criminal or an aspiring criminal, and that's just not true. It's a very, very small minority.
I mean, you've been in the media for a very, very long time, and I think the biggest culprits of that are television, because the images are much more visceral, and they come at you a lot faster than reading a detailed, nuanced story about any of this will come at you. Dan, how much longer are you going to... I'm going to keep you for the whole show, if that's okay.
I got
one quick song to play at the end, but I just so like talking to you. You've got this wonderful principal who's been there for a few years. He has really reinvigorated it, and in a sense reinvigorated you too, has he not?
He has indeed. I don't mean to disparage his predecessor, but he was not a Leo guy. He didn't really have any skin in the game, and I think his mandate, or he felt his mandate, was keep it open till we tell you to close it, because there were no recruiting initiatives, no academic initiatives. We were just kind of dead in the water. And, you know, it happens. Hales Franciscan is gone. Seton is gone.
Right.
We are the last exclusively African-American Catholic school in the city. And it's very, very important that we hold on. And I just knew I had this alumni base that did not want us to close.
Yep.
And I just had a sense that I could go to them. And there's a wonderful guy named Pete Doyle, who was an Irish Christian brother during my student days.
Mm-hmm.
And then he left the brothers, got married, returned to Leo, taught for a number of years, and he's retired now, but I still run into him from time to time, and he's just a delightful guy. And if he said it once, he said it 15 times. He's, Dan, God does not want Leo to close. I think there's some truth to that.
It's always good to talk with someone who hears from God.
Yeah.
We got to take one last.
You know, in the last four or five years or so, that talk is pretty much gone. When I first started, it was, Leo's still open? Or,
yeah.
So I'd go out and do some recruiting, and I'd hear, I didn't know Leo was still open. Well, yes, we are.
Mm.
And, you know, then there'd be a lot of some of our rivals in recruiting would say, you don't want to go to Leo. They're going to close.
Yeah.
Well, we don't hear that anymore. I think we've strengthened our presence and raised our profile.
Let's take a break. I'm going to come back and talk to Dan McGrath about what his wife has been through recently, because Dan's wife, not only is Dan an admirable person, his wife is probably more admirable. She she is a nurse, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. When this studio reopens to the public and to guests, I would love it. When you open, and when you think hope with hope, you might open by August to have you and your young principal in here. I got to meet this kid. He may not be a kid. Well, he's a kid to me.
Mid-40s, but just
that's a kid.
You know, young at heart. And he's been a fantastic addition. He just when I met him,
yeah.
I just said to myself, I've got to get this guy in the building. And when we were finally able to do it, he's exceeded my highest expectations. He's just done a wonderful job.
Isn't that a good feeling?
Yeah, he's invigorated the whole community. And, you know, as I say, the kids feel good about being there. Their parents feel good about having them there. But, you know, he's not just a cheerleader. He's a very effective urban educator.
Well, he also seems very sincere about it, too. How is your wife
about the
doing?
Kids,
how
the kids know he cares.
How has your wife been holding up? She's a nurse, been a nurse at Northwestern. These last 4 months must have...
Oh, boy. She's 60-hour weeks are easy. But, you know, I will say Northwestern, they're pros. They know what they're doing. They kind of saw this coming. They had beds set aside. They were going to treat every COVID patient that they had to treat. And they tried to limit the patients who were non-COVID, you know, treat them by telemed. So she runs but she's very involved in the Bloom Cardiovascular Clinic.
Sure.
So they've been trying to keep those people away from the hospital as best they can and just treat them by telemed and whatever. But then she also has extensive ICU experience. So they went through some all-hands-on-deck ICU days where she was called upon. So
I'm sort of amazed she and I didn't cross paths when I was in the ICU.
If I had known you were there, I'd have been for you.
Nobody knew. Me well enough. This was not for broadcast news. When I went back, I had to tell a couple people at the paper, and when I went back to the paper, there were a couple of the editors were like, you've got to write about this. You've got to write about this. And you know me well enough to know that I'm like, well, wait a minute. See, there are people dying of this out there, and I am not going to write a piece about how I beat COVID. No, thank you. No, thank you. I do want you to come in here with your young friend.
I'll be happy to do it.
Let me know when the school's opening, because I also wonder, you could have a couple of kids in here. We could do the whole 2 hours.
The kids are the best ambassadors we have. You should hear our choir. You're a music buff.
Yes.
And the choir, they've attracted a lot of attention. They appear all over the city. And
can't wait.
They represent us. Our choir director is a professional gospel entertainer named LaDonna Hill, and she has this tremendous love of music that she's able to transmit to the kids. And there's some real cachet to being in the Leo choir because of all the opportunities they get.
It's a remarkable story, and you started right. I loved your writing whenever that byline appeared in any paper, even the News Cooperative. And the story, the story you've been writing for the last 10 years is the important story of your life, Dan McGrath. And
it's gratifying and rewarding, and I've you know, there have been some rough times, but we're in a good spot now. I love the kids. The interaction with the kids is what keeps me going.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can see the progress that we've made. I can see where, you know, every year there's a kid or two that I look at them and I think, you know, if he hadn't come here, I don't know what would have become of him. So as long as we're making a difference like that, the work is definitely worth doing.
There are a lot of kids there who, if they hadn't found, you know, Leo in its way, is not just a safe haven for many of these kids. It is like a life raft.
Yeah, we need you here.
Yeah, it is like a life raft. Dan, it is always good to talk to you.
Oh, great. Rick. Thanks for having me on, and I'm really delighted that you're doing well, and
I'm surviving.
Great to have you up and around and in the paper.
Yeah, don't forget that I work for a newspaper. don't forget. Don't ever forget that, Dan, because you understand as well as anybody. It's great to talk to you. Love to your wife. Love to you, and I will see you as soon as I am able to see you.
Thanks again. Take care, Dan.
Bye-bye. Wonderful guy. Go to leohighschool.org if you'd like more information about this place. It really is a great, unbelievably interesting urban success story. Also the alma mater of Jack and Bill Hessian. I want to play for you now in this show. I was going to interview Dan Long about what he's been doing during this whole 4 month interlude from real life, but he'll still have the same stories next week. When we are on, mind you, from 7 to 9, the more civilized hours of 7 to 9. Now I want to end this this edition of After Hours with, last week I played that amazing Brother, Where Are You by Oscar Brown. This song, I was just digging around for music and thinking about music. Curtis Mayfield, who grew up in the Cabrini-Green and went on to become one of the most successful recording artists ever, also had his own record label, and then sadly the last few years of his life was paralyzed. He wrote in 1963 a song called People Get Ready that Martin Luther King called and named that song as the unofficial anthem of the civil rights movement. He used the people to not just get ready to march, but, and this is the point, to comfort and calm them. I end the show with this. See you next Sunday at 7 p.m.
Don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealers honing. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. The train to Jordan, picking up passengers coast to coast. Faith is the key. Open the doors and board 'em. There's hope for all among those loved the most. Against the